Ted, are you getting ready for a big Thanksgiving out your way?
I am, yes. Looking forward to it. Planning to go to the parade tomorrow in New York City, but might be rainy, so we'll see.
Ted Rossman is the senior industry analyst at Bankrate, and the folks are shopping. What's the report say about all of that?
It's going to be a big weekend for shopping, obviously, although I'll note that it's not the kickoff that it used to be. It's really more of the midpoint of the holiday shopping season now. A lot of the good deals actually started in early October, but they're still out there. They're going to be out there through the end of the year. 59% of us are likely to buy something on Cyber Monday. That's ahead of Black Friday at 53% and Small Business Saturdays at 50%. Like I said, though, the big trends are people starting earlier, people favoring online shopping over in-person, and people being relatively frugal this year. Sales are likely to grow 2 or 3 percentage points over last year, but people are being thoughtful about how much they spend.
Well, those are mixed messages. I did hear that spending was going to be slightly higher than last year. Is that frugal or not?
Well, inflation is still the elephant in the room. The cumulative toll has been about 20% since early 2021. That's really how much prices have gone up in total. Wages have gone up an average of 17% during that span. So that's why people are not feeling great about the economy, even though a lot of the underlying data has actually been pretty good. When it comes to that 2 or 3% increase this year, that's what the National Retail Federation is saying, and MasterCard and Deloitte and a lot of others. That more or less matches the inflation rate, depending on the metric that you use.
Yeah.
So it's kind of this whole, like, yeah, we're spending more, but we're not necessarily getting more. That's part of what's frustrating people, too. Many say they're cutting back. We actually found that only 1 in 4 holiday shoppers says that they're going to spend more this year than they did last year. Some people might end up spending more, though, because of inflation or impulse buys, or, you know, sometimes it's hard to kind of pin the nail on the donkey with some of the surveys.
So. Well, I'm always a little jaded's not the right word, but when people say, here's what I'm going to spend, I've been to that movie. Guess what? You're going to spend more. It's not uncommon. One other quick question from you, and maybe you already answered this. Online versus in-store shopping, do you have the ratio or what's going on there?
We found that 43% are likely to make most of their buys online, only 20% with most of their buys in person. Everybody else is kind of about the same. So definitely a strong online focus this year. And mobile shopping is actually supposed to outpace computer-based buys for the first time. So we're getting more comfortable transacting on the small phone screens.
People will do that again. What percentage are shopping on their phone versus a desktop or laptop?
You know, I don't have the specific breakout, but I know that it's forecast that mobile shopping is going to outpace computer-based shopping for the first time. So I think it's slight, you know, maybe like a 51-49
right,
kind of thing.
Right.
But slight benefit to phone shopping this year, which is a big change. We used to browse on our phones and buy on our computers. Now we're actually buying on the phone as well.
That's amazing. Boy, times have changed. We'll talk about in-store small business shopping in a minute with our next guest. I know you've got numbers on that, too. Ted Rossman, the senior industry analyst at Bankrate. Find out interesting information like this at Bankrate.com. Ted, nice to talk to you today. Thanks for your help.
No problem. Happy Thanksgiving.
We were talking to Ted Rossman from Bankrate about Christmas shopping and maybe people going into brick-and-mortar stores, especially the small business ones. Let's talk a little bit about the small business scene. Elliot Richardson is here, the co-founder and president of the Small Business Advocacy Council. Elliot, you're on WGN. How are you?
Hey, John. Thank you so much for having me today. Yeah, that last individual was a great segue into this one.
How so? I mean, talk to me about how you guys are doing and what you're trying to do for small businesses.
Yeah, you know, look, with Small Business Saturday coming up, you know, what we really want to do is have politicians and policymakers in the city of Chicago focus on unleashing entrepreneurs and supporting small businesses by reducing and streamlining processes and eliminating bureaucracies that are really keeping small businesses from opening, from growing in a manner that is not too costly and doesn't take too much time.
I know you've got a raft of initiatives that you'd like to see the city adopt. But before you start to talk about the most important of those, how easy is it for a small business, in your estimation, to do business in Chicago?
Well, it depends on the business, number one, and it depends on what the business is trying to do, John. So, you know, certainly sometimes it's not that difficult, right? If you don't need a special use permit, if your inspections are done in a timely and a consistent manner, I think for some businesses, they're able to do well. Others, there is a lot of red tape, a lot of bureaucracy, and a lot of time and costs involved in just operating and running the business. So, no, I mean, Chicago needs to make a lot of improvements.
Give me some examples. What would you like to see us do differently?
Yeah, I mean, we've got the small business package, and I just want to say it. It's been endorsed by 32 members of the Chicago City Council. John, that's tough to do, right, to get that kind of consensus among City Council members. Let's streamline the zoning process. Right now, if you want to get a special use permit, if you want to go into an area and alter some of the zoning that might keep a business out, that takes a full-on hearing with attorneys, with experts. It's so costly, so time-consuming. Let's make most of those an administrative process and have it move way more smooth. There's no reason to have experts and attorneys in a lot of these cases. So let's streamline those processes. Inspections. I mean, timely, consistent inspections. We hear from businesses and groups across Chicago that it really holds them back when they don't know when an inspection is going to occur. They don't know if one inspection is going to be the same as the other. And, you know, small businesses and local businesses crave certainty. And you can't have certainty, John, if you don't know what's coming next from inspectors.
One of the things on your list, I just want to give an example. Sidewalk yeah. cafes should have the option to automatically renew their license on an annual basis unless there's an objection by the alderperson or staff. I think that's interesting the way that's put. You shouldn't be immune to objections. If there are some, they need to be dealt with. But if there are none, I don't see why it wouldn't renew automatically. It doesn't, huh?
No, and it's low-hanging fruit, and I was going to that next, so thank you. I mean, that one is easy, right? Every year, at the beginning of the year, there's this mad dash to try to get a new sidewalk cafe permit, right? And you know businesses want to open and start serving outside maybe in April, as soon as they possibly can.
Customers want it, too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as soon as people can get outside, remember how nice it was?
Yep.
I think it was last February. I mean, if you can get outside, people want to be outside. Why should you have to wait in line? Why should it take so much time and money? Just have those things automatically renew. And if there's an objection, if an alderperson has an objection, we want to hear that. I mean, that should be part of the process too. But there's no reason for this extra red tape and bureaucracy that actually costs the city money. I mean, we're talking about right now a budget crisis with the city of Chicago. Let's reduce red tape. Let's streamline processes, because that's also going to save the city money. But on top of that, it's going to generate sales tax. It's going to generate revenue in the right way without increasing taxes.
I bet that it says here, eliminate the requirement for a special use permit application to be notarized. It would seem to me like if the right people see it, approve it, or object to it, if it has a process, I'm not sure what the value is of that stamp. Can you talk about that?
I mean, it's at zero value, John. I'll make it real easy. I mean, there's no reason for these things to be notarized. It's just another step. It's like having to go to City Hall and fill out a paper permit. I mean, right now, you know, if you're on the south side or if you're on the northwest side, getting to City Hall, I mean, that's not an easy track, and it's not an inexpensive track, and it could be a day for a business owner, right? So notary, low-hanging fruit, right? Allowing people to file permits online, low-hanging fruit. And all of this improves the perception of Chicago's business climate. So, yeah, sorry. I gave you a quick answer, then I made it long-winded.
No, but that's
but
well, no,
no
I,
value.
I value what you're saying. But one last thing about this. Elliot Richardson's the co-founder and president of the Small Business Advisory Council. I can imagine the alderperson sign on this. Why wouldn't they want to endorse it at least verbally or on paper? But will they actually pass ordinances to accomplish this? What do you expect can happen in 2025?
Well, you know what? I hope you have me back on and I'll report on it, because the first ordinance was filed. So Alderman Desmond Yancey filed the ordinance that would move most special use permits towards an administrative process as opposed to this really cumbersome, costly, and time-consuming hearing.
Are you surprised to hear that? Because they all protect their fiefdoms. That's been a problem larger than what you and I are talking about here in Chicago for years. It's the alderman's, you know, little fiefdom, and they want control of even the silliest, smallest things. I'm surprised they're yielding some of that.
Well, see, and here's the thing. An alder person can still weigh in on things like, actually in the same way, in things like a special use permit. It's just it doesn't have to go through this hearing process. It can go through an administrative process. And, you know, what we're seeing is the alders right now, I mean, they want to move some of this, I keep calling it low-hanging fruit, right? Eliminate some of this redundancy and streamline processes. Because small businesses need a win in the city. I mean, they really do. Local businesses need a win in the city.
All right, let's do this.
And these are great ways to deliver it.
Let's do this then. Let's check in after the keep me posted. Let's see whatever the appropriate time is, Elliot. You jump back in here, okay?
You got it. And thank you so much, John, for providing me the opportunity to chat with you about all this.
Good luck to you. Much as we talk about college athletics and money these days, here's an interesting conversation a little bit along those lines. Michael Haddix Jr. is the CEO of Scout, and we'll tell you about what this firm is now that Michael has founded. Michael, you're on WGN. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing today?
Really good. I think I recognize the name. Your dad was in the NFL, right?
He did. He was the number 8 pick in the 83 NFL draft, that Elway to Marino draft.
Is that how we remember drafts, by the name of the quarterback who went in the first round?
I think they had the 30 for 30 on it, so it sort of sticks in my head, and people bring it up pretty often.
Yeah.
So that one is an important one to me.
I can imagine, because then your dad gets the deal. He's playing in the NFL, probably got a big paycheck or two. What happened to your dad's or your family's money?
Yeah, so I think, you know, it's sort of the common experience. I think we see the headlines, right? We see this, the number of 80% of athletes go broke within 3 years, and I lived through that. But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't 10 cars. It wasn't kind of all these other things. It was this idea that my dad's from small town Mississippi, so you get drafted, you don't know anything about money, you get an influx of cash, and by the time you understand how money works, your career's over. And I think that was sort of the experience of me watching him sort of hit the reset button at, you know, 28 years old, and me watching him learn how money worked. But it's, you know, when your high income earning years are over, right, playing catch up is pretty tough. So yeah, that's the experience that I had and saw it sort of firsthand, how life changes post-career.
Were you an athlete? I know you got an MBA from the Columbia Business School. Did you play sports as well?
I did. So I played college basketball at Siena College in upstate New York. I had a pretty good career, like 1,600 points. So I had a pretty good career. I looked like a football player, but I played Division I basketball.
What fun. Then you go on to be an investment banker at Goldman Sachs. And then you move to Octagon. A lot of us are familiar with that name. So now you are giving financial advice to Steph Curry and Chris Paul and Ali Raisman and Michael Phelps, right?
Yeah, so the interesting thing about that was, you know, when I went to Columbia for business school, and then I worked on Wall Street as an investment banker, and I saw this sort of way that money was spoken about, these tips and tricks and truly really unique sort of perspective on how your money should make money. And I just, you know, had this thought of thinking back to my dad and saying, how do we take that and apply it to people that don't really have that access or haven't had that experience? And that's how I went over to Octagon, and we had a sort of this family office that managed money for, we had about $1 billion under management for all these different athletes. So tennis, soccer, baseball, Olympic sports, football, basketball. So I really wanted to take those lessons and apply it to, you know, a piece of the population who really isn't getting the best financial advice.
So then you open up this business called Scout. So are you working for professional athletes or college athletes? Are you maybe working for college students? What's your objective now?
Yeah, so my goal was always, you know, you look at the pro athletes, and while they still need the help in the education, right, like you can make a lot of mistakes with $100 million. And I looked at the college opportunity to say, let's help these young athletes, especially now making NIL, who this may be the most money they ever make as a 19 and 20-year-old, knowing that, you know, the numbers of going to the pros haven't changed, right? It's still, you know, less than 1%. So this idea was, how do you go affect a larger group of the population that can really leverage the fact that they may get 50 or 100, or, you know, some of these college athletes are getting millions, but they're getting money at college. And if you do it right, you can really give yourself a head start for the rest of your life. So that's the goal there. So we work with schools directly. So our goal is always to not charge the players. So say a school would pay us in the same way that, you know, you work for a company, you get a 401k, you know, that your company pays for that. They give you some resources. We wanted to be that for college athletics as a whole.
So then you aren't, this isn't a class that you're offering. Is it a seminar? Is it an ongoing service? And I presume we're talking about college athletes then.
Yeah. So for college athletes, what we do is we go educate first, right? We want to give them this understanding and really level set why this is so important. But we've developed a tech platform, and our thesis was, if you look at all the traditional sort of ways that you can invest your money and plan, they're all built for a population who's going to make the most money they've ever made when they're 40, 50, or 60 years old. So they're built for the majority. So we wanted to create this tech platform that was built for this unique group of people mm-hmm. who are independent contractors, who are making money at 19, who are becoming breadwinners of, you know, of their family overnight, and who have a really short earning window. Can we create a solution for them? And it's that education, but it's a tech platform, and the goal is constant support, knowing that you may encounter a financial question or an issue 3 months when we walk out of that room, or 8 months later, and you shouldn't be left out to dry when something happens to you that you need to solve for.
So many of these athletes are now getting $100,000, maybe not $100 million, but it, as you said, that may be the most money they make, or make for a very long time. They could make big mistakes with that small amount of money. So it would seem to me like every Big Ten and SEC school should have you, you know, as a service for their student athletes.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I agree, but we, you know, we have a good amount of Big Ten and a good amount of SEC schools,
and DePaul too, right?
Yeah, DePaul is a client of ours, and I've known, you know, the folks at DePaul for a long time, and yeah, they've been a great client. I think the one piece is, you know, while they may not be making the millions of dollars, you know, as anybody in finance knows, compound interest is the eighth wonder of the world, right? If you do this right at 19 or 20. That money you make then could become millions with a few sort of smart moves. Yeah. So because they have the luxury of time, let's get ahead of this. And that's really important to us.
Yeah, we all have the luxury of time. We just didn't know it at the time. And that's
100%.
That's the problem. But boy, if you get a kid with $20, $50, $100,000 and they're 18 and they don't spend it on a car or jewelry, then the opportunity is so great for them. So then you must have a very select view on NIL these days. You must think that's terrific, eh?
Yeah. I think it's a great opportunity, right?
I'm shocked to hear you say that, Michael. Just shocked. Shocked to hear you say that.
Yeah. Well, what I would say is, I think, like anything in this country, right, you sort of get what you earn, right? You get your value. And I think the one piece of it is there are stadiums that are filled up, right? You go watch, you know, Alabama play Georgia, right? There's 110,000 people in that stadium. There's probably, you know, a couple million that are going to Tuscaloosa for a game and injecting capital into that whole ecosystem, or things on TV. So, you know, I think it's an opportunity for players to sort of earn their value and, you know, take advantage of the sacrifice that they've made. I always, you know, say it's people see the Saturdays of football or see those people playing on TV in basketball or some of the other sports. They don't see that it's taken 15 or 16 years of hard work to actually
absolutely.
Get there.
No, I get that, but here's the thing. And I'm not challenging you on this, but I'm interested in your thought about this. So then the kid from LSU goes to Michigan, and he's going to get $10, $12 million. Some of us sort of hate to see college sports devolve into that. What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, my thought is, you know, I think, you know, you look at what your TV contracts have become. You look at, you know, the big house in Michigan, you know, their stadium has over 100,000 people. You see the money that these schools are generating. So I think it's right that players are able to get a piece of that. And I understand it's, you know, hey, you know, you're going to school, you're getting free education. But I will say, you know, people are going to sit in those stands and they're, you know, they're scalping tickets and they're buying jerseys and they're paying all this money to go not watch you sit in class. They're going to watch you play sports, right? So somebody should be getting a piece of that because you put some work in there. So I agree that, you know, I see both sides of it. But what I will say is I'm really focused on how do we help make sure that opportunity, that limited window of opportunity that this player has benefits them and they become good stewards of capital.
Isn't that the truth? I mean, you didn't make the decision to create NIL, but if the kid's going to get that money, let's help guide them in the handling of that. And that's what, and I'm glad to hear that it's the program includes DePaul University now. That's not a big NIL school yet, but I'd like it to be. Michael Haddix Jr. is the CEO of Scout, scoutfw.com.
Scoutfw.com.
There it is. Thank you. Hey, let's talk again, Michael. Really nice to meet you. Thanks for joining us today.
Great. Likewise. Have a great day.
More business news. Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Electric car maker Rivian, which builds vehicles in downstate Normal, is poised to receive a large federal loan to build a new factory in Georgia. The U.S. Department of Energy has announced a plan to give the startup a $6 billion loan to start construction of the plant east of Atlanta. The loan is subject to approval and will require the car maker to adhere to certain conditions. The plant is expected to bring about 7,500 jobs to Georgia and has been called the second largest economic development project in that state's history. Rivian says the plant would have the capacity to make an additional 200,000 electric vehicles over the course of several years. Operations at the Illinois plant would not be affected. Governor Pritzker has bought two floors of a 38-story North Side Chicago building from fellow billionaire Ken Griffin. The deal for the property at 9 West Walton is an estimated $19 million, according to the Chicago Tribune. That's the highest anyone has paid for a residence in the Chicago area this year and fourth highest ever in Chicago. Griffin has heavily funded Republican candidates, including an effort to unseat the Democrat Pritzker in 2022. Griffin moved to Miami. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
The Business of Food with Steve Alexander.
Thank you, and let's begin with a dad who heard noises in the kitchen.
I get in there, and our two-year-old had moved a stool over and put an apple into the microwave, hit a few buttons, and got it started.
Yikes. More about that after I thank the Chevy Silverado for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Find out how at ChevyDriveChicago.com. Okay, that dad we just heard from whose toddler put an apple in the microwave and turned it on? That was Dr. Kyron Quinlan, head of the pediatrics division at Rush University Medical Center.
It's amazing. Kids 18 months, 2 years old, they are already able to do what it takes to turn on a microwave, to open a microwave, to take the thing out of the microwave and definitely scald themselves.
And end up in ERs and burn units.
About 700 kids a year are brought to the emergency room for exactly this type of burn, where a young child opens the door of a microwave oven, pulls out the soup or whatever, pours it on themselves, has a severe scald, and now they're needing to go to the emergency room for care.
Incredibly painful and disfiguring burns in some cases. So he and his colleagues at Rush and at the University of Chicago Burn Unit decided something had to be done.
What if we made it so that the doors of a microwave oven were harder to open for a child? The same concept of like a pill bottle in child-resistant packaging.
And what better place to get such a device mandated than Underwriter Laboratories in Northbrook?
Yeah, we went up there and presented a bunch of our research and data and...
And waited.
It took years of trying. We did research studies. We demonstrated the problem at the burn unit at University of Chicago.
There is a committee at UL that sets standards for products.
It came up for a vote. And it failed.
Undaunted, Dr. Quinlan and a colleague from the University of Chicago joined the standards committee.
And then it came up for a vote again and finally passed.
And now, effective in March of this year,
all microwaves in the United States will have child-resistant doors and kids will be protected.
Hats off to Dr. Quinlan and his colleagues, including Dr. Gina Lowell at Rush, Dr. Larry Gottlieb at the University of Chicago, and Marla Robinson, an occupational therapist there. Meanwhile, parents, grandparents, caregivers, keep an eye on those kiddos, especially now during the busiest times of the year in the kitchen during the holidays. On the food calendar today, it's National Kraft Jerky Day and National Bavarian Cream Pie Day. I'm Steve Alexander, and that's the Business of Food Safety on 720 WGN.
I'm glad we're checking in again. We talked about this before, but we needed to hear the payoff. Laura Epstein is here, the CEO at Pulse Charter Connect, where they have this Tech Rise by P33 competition. Thanks for joining us again. How are you?
Good. Thank you for having me. How are you?
Good. Okay. We got just a couple minutes. Tell us a little bit about this competition, this contest.
Sure. So we participated in TechRise Chicago, and it was truly incredible. It's for underrepresented founders, and they brought together the Chicago startup ecosystem of founders, industry experts, and investors in a way that made connecting feel natural and impactful. It was a great opportunity to have face-to-face conversations and get warm introduction to help secure funding and build meaningful partnerships.
You know, pardon me, I've mistakenly suggested that you are the person that was running the competition. You're actually the winner of this competition, aren't you?
Yes, but I still am a strong advocate because their team has been incredible.
You can do both. You're very good.
Yeah.
Okay, so tell us about your business then. Tell us what you do.
Sure. So Pulse Charter Connect is a supply chain and logistics software company dedicated to improving the efficiency of organ transportation for hospitals, health systems, and medical centers.
And what made you realize there was a need for that service?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been interested in finding ways to use aviation to make a real difference in people's lives. And as an engineer and pilot, I saw these inefficiencies up close while working in the industry. And then once I had some close friends impacted by transplants, I knew I had to step up and do something to help.
So the name Pulse, Charter, Connect, those three words married together sort of describe what you do.
Exactly. It's quite literal.
And then is it a $100,000 prize?
Yes. It's a $100,000 grant.
How will you apply that?
Yeah, so as we're entering 2025, we're really looking to expand nationally and launch multiple hospital contracts across the country. By optimizing these logistics, we aim to reduce the staggering statistic of 17 people dying each day while waiting for a transplant. The $100,000 is really going to be spent to further develop our technology and scale this national footprint, ensuring we save more lives and support more hospitals.
What a great business and opportunity, but you had to score on that pitch. How nervous were you when you were selling it to the judges?
Yeah, I'd say that everybody was super welcoming, but of course there's stage fright just presenting in front of, I think it was 500 people in the audience. So I was definitely glad to relax after the pitch was completed.
And then is this then going to be franchised, if you will, across the country? Hospitals, airports, small airports, sort of being part of this Charter Connect?
Sure. So we have a software system, so we're definitely looking to expand nationally, not quite in a franchise, but have all of these different participants be users of the tool.
Wow. Congratulations, Laura. I'm glad you won. I'm glad this service exists, and it sounds like it's going to get even bigger and more efficient. Congratulations to you all.
Thank you so much.
Laura Epstein is the grand prize winner, $100,000. Well done.